Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While, by Phil Guyman, and narrated by Phil Guyman. Introduction. I awoke in the middle of the afternoon on a sidewalk in Trinidad, wrapped in a strip of dusty carpet I'd torn from a roll in a stranger's garage. My left arm was numb from its roll as a pillow, so I shook it out, using my right hand to brush away the flies buzzing around my eyes, before I dug through my backpack to find the jersey of whatever team I was sweating for that week, with riders I'd never heard of and sponsor names I couldn't pronounce. At 26 years old, I'd won some big races that season, finally clawing my way to a real pro contract after years of hard work and sacrifice. I thought that meant that the tough times were behind me, but now I knew that I was wrong. Will this ever end? When do I get to feel like I've made it? When I was a kid, celebrities and athletes told my generation to never give up on our dreams, promising that if we dug deep and believed in ourselves, we could also achieve great things. It sounds nice, but they left out that for every big winner, there were thousands who put in the same effort, but just weren't good enough. The losers don't get a microphone to tell their story, so you don't realize how much failure is out there and your perspective is skewed. I guess I was lucky to land somewhere in the middle. I was born the day of the Challenger space shuttle disaster, so I saw myself as an astronaut eventually, but I wouldn't have ruled out the next Michael Jordan. Dreams that must have worried my parents. Mom was raised in Brooklyn. By 24, she'd finished a PhD in management at Carnegie Mellon University, where she met my dad. He grew up in post-World War II Germany and came to the United States on a Fulbright scholarship to study computer science. They both earned tenure as professors at Georgia Tech, so while Jordan told me to just do it, my parents reminded me of a guy who once laced my Nikes at StrideRight and talked about his years playing pro basketball in Europe. A cautionary tale to show me and my sister the value of practical goals, security, and stability. Mom and Dad made good money, but they cut coupons from the newspaper and drove Toyotas with roll-down windows, saving up for our college funds or a rainy day. We lived in Tucker, Georgia, an old railroad town turned suburb near Atlanta, where the shops on Main Street all had names like Grandma's Attic and never lasted more than a year or two. Bikeways of Tucker was across the tracks past the hardware store, and rumor has it, before it was filled with spokes and sprockets, the building was a meeting place for the KKK. When the Olympics came to Atlanta in 1996, we went to the track and field finals. I was 10 years old, in awe, imagining what it would be like to join that club, to be one of the best athletes in the world. I could see that nothing on earth was more coveted or harder earned than a gold medal. Dad always thought that sports were silly, but he humored me on my birthday, spending $299 at Sports Authority and mixing cement in a wheelbarrow to install a basketball hoop in our driveway. It came out a little crooked, but I never said a word. The closest thing my family did to sports or exercise was riding bikes together. One of my earliest memories is visiting my dad's relatives in Germany, where we took a day trip to the Netherlands, exploring local paths on borrowed cruisers. I remember having lunch at a restaurant by a river, with a water wheel at the entrance. Dutch pancakes are yellow and the size of a manhole cover, so I shared one with my sister, and on the way home, Dad had to push me into the headwind or we'd never have made it back. Every summer, my parents will load up the minivan and rent a house on Jekyll Island, Georgia for a week. Dad and I got up early to ride our Huffies to the cafe in the courtyard of the Jekyll Island Club Hotel. He'd buy a coffee and a newspaper, and I'd have a fudge brownie chip cookie, which was the greatest thing I'd ever tasted. I teased my dad for always carrying a backpack when we were on vacation, but he liked to stop at the market for groceries on the way home. I remember once when the express lane was 15 items or less, he counted 16 in our basket and waited in the longer line, refusing to put back the flowers he'd bought for my mom. Dad followed the rules, and he stuck to his principles. At 17, I thought I was too old to do the Jekyll trip with my parents, so I'd get the cookie with my dad, ride an angst-fueled lap of the island by myself, and watch TV at the rental house while they went to the beach. At first, I was annoyed that there was nothing on other than the Tour de France, but then Tyler Hamilton won a stage with a broken collarbone, and Lance Armstrong crashed but still beat Jan Ulrich up the mountains on the way to his fifth win. Dad said I was wasting my vacation. Why would anyone care who wins a bike race, he asked. But I had to see if Lance's Discovery Channel team would catch the breakaway, pulling in the wind while Armstrong hid in their draft to save energy for his next devastating attack. There were all sorts of prizes and races within the race that affected team strategies, from stage victories and sprints to the King of the Mountains jersey for the best climber. Sweeping around castles and coastlines, the peloton was a symphony, and bike racing was a magical combination of a fistfight and a chess match. The city of Atlanta is basically owned by the Coca-Cola company, so our school had vending machines filled with soda, and I don't remember ever drinking water as a kid. I spent most of my teens obese and depressed, never a fan of exercise, but when we got back from Jekyll, I headed straight to Bikeways, where the owner sold me a used Trek 1200 hybrid. It was two sizes too small, so I can confirm that he was a jerk, if not a KKK member, but I loved the freedom it brought me. Riding with my friends, I was an explorer, seeing the world for the first time. When I got home, I'd catch myself smiling and singing as I leaned my bike against the wall in the garage, and I could tell it was good for my soul. I'd lost 45 pounds by the time I arrived at the University of Florida for college, so I was known as Skinny Phil to the UF Cycling Club, and I was more interested in learning how to draft than in doing my homework. I bought a racing bike on eBay and came back to Tucker for Christmas with shaved legs and tights. Dad shook his head in a scene right out of Breaking Away. Bikeways went out of business, and I noticed a sign on Main Street announcing a beautification project. Tucker planned to remove a lane of traffic to make room for more parking, and they'd already added raised cement areas filled with soil and gray foot-high twigs. I pictured the meeting where officials delegated funds for the project and wondered if anybody had addressed the elephant in the room. Tucker has its charm like any other antique, but it's old, dirty, and full of proud history. You can't fix it. As I crossed the railroad tracks, a pickup truck slowed down next to me and rolled down the window. "Get off the road, faggot!" I trained hard that winter, and my brain released some great chemicals when I won my first race. I was addicted, and nothing else mattered for the next 10 years of my life. I felt more alive when I was racing, and it was the first thing I'd ever done that I was immediately good at. When a friend brought me into a sports lab, I scored an off-the-charts VO2 max of 88, and it felt like I discovered a superpower. Lacking in fast-twitch muscles, I lost every sprint, but I was always fastest up a hill, and I usually won time trials, known as TTs, a discipline where riders compete against the clock on special bikes. In the summers, friends would go off to internships and think about silly things like careers, while I roamed the East Coast, rocketing up the amateur categories. Like a crooked itinerant preacher, I'd show up in your town, do a little damage at the local race, and leave. Often I'd barely make enough to cover gas and a burrito on the way home, but sometimes I'd walk away with $1,000, and by 20 years old, I'd won enough to join an elite amateur team, attending the biggest events on the national racing calendar. Pro athletes seem to dwell on their doubters. Michael Jordan always mentioned the high school coach who cut him from the team, but the only doubter I remember coming across in those years was the director of the USA Cycling National Development Program, which grooms young Americans for the UCI World Tour, the top level of pro cycling. I was a college sophomore when he said I was too old to join them in Belgium, that I should stay in school. Whatever. Who wants to hang out in Belgium? I'm sure I'd get sick of waffles after a few weeks. My parents would have killed me if I dropped out anyway. Dad thought I was wasting my time riding my bike so much, but I wouldn't call him a doubter. He just wanted what was best for me. To him, the World Tour was men wearing tights, playing a game, with legs shaved for no reason. But to me, Lance and his colleagues were gladiators, the peak of human potential and strength and endurance and teamwork, carved out of granite. Okay, fine. Wearing tights, with legs shaved for no reason. Believers were much louder than doubters in those years. When I considered law school, all I heard from older guys on the group ride was how miserable it was to have a regular job. They promised that I had talent, that I could be a professional athlete, and live the dream. I thought they were being encouraging, but I know the truth now. Those men weren't thinking about my future at all. They were remembering a time that they'd given up themselves. Not necessarily on bike racing, but at some point they'd set a dream aside. Now, maybe they had a career, a happy family, and a $5,000 bicycle, but there were still ups and downs. It was easy to think that if only they'd gone for it, life would be perfect. Lance Armstrong's inspirational story made him a household name, and when my dad was diagnosed with cancer, my mom found strength from his book. Dad beat it after months of radiation and chemo, and Mom emerged a cycling fan. When Lance came back from retirement in 2009, corporate sponsors were plentiful, so established teams had real money, and it was easy for young riders to find jobs on continental programs, considered the minor leagues of pro cycling. At 22, I joined one sponsored by Jelly Belly, so I got a bike custom painted with jelly beans, jerseys covered in candy, and luggage with the team logo and my name printed on it. It sounds ridiculous, but I'd never felt more proud. When you hear pro athlete, you might picture trashed hotel rooms and fancy cars, but that wasn't my experience on Jelly Belly exactly. Top guys at our level were making six figures, but the median salary was more like $15,000 a year, and mine was $167 a month. I crisscrossed America in a Toyota Matrix with roll-down windows, meeting my teammates at untelevised races with meager prize money in towns you've never heard of. We stayed with host families, who often learned the hard way to never say, "Help yourself," to the pantry. When Jelly Belly only offered me $6,000 to stay another year, I moved to a smaller team sponsored by Kenda Tires. They paid me a life-changing $15,000, but we weren't good enough to be invited to the tours of California, Utah, and Colorado, the only events where continental riders could show our ability to the top teams. Instead, we went to any low-level stage race that would pay our travel expenses, or criteriums, fast races through city streets with hay bales stacked on the sidewalk by the sharper corners, because they know someone will crash there. I finished second overall at the 5-day tour of Taiwan, behind a guy who'd served a 2-year EPO suspension. But I tore my chin open when the lead motorcycle crashed at the tour of the demilitarized zone in Korea. If there was a tour of Somalia with a free buffet, I'd have been there. The UCI, Union Cycliste Internationale, cycling's governing body, requires pros to have health insurance, but teams rarely provide it. On my salary, I signed up, showed them the card to get my racing license, and then canceled the policy. My parents feared that I was throwing away the money they'd spent on my education. I was. But they still cared, so they made me renew the insurance and paid for it themselves. I thought I'd be living the dream when I turned pro, but I was far from independent, secure, or stable. I just did it, MJ. So now what? Continental riders all hoped to move up to the World Tour. Sprinters craved a pounding from the legendary cobbled classics like Paris-Roubaix, while climbers dreamed of competing in a 3-week Grand Tour. But out of over 100 guys on the circuit with the same goal, maybe one made it to Europe every couple of years. Those were bad odds, but the short season left plenty of time to try other things to pay the bills. I worked with private coaching clients, got published as a freelance writer for magazines, and started a business that sold cycling clothes online. Some of that did pretty well, but I still lived cheap, saving money, sure that every dollar I made would be my last. I tried dating during those years, but couldn't make anything work. Too busy supporting my dream like a responsible person might support a family. When a girlfriend said she wanted to spend more quality time, I made some popcorn, turned on a movie, and did crunches on the carpet, sending emails for my business between sets. For some reason, she still wanted to get married, but we split up when she said she wanted kids someday. I was having so much trouble taking care of myself, I couldn't imagine that kind of responsibility. I haven't painted a pretty picture of the continental lifestyle, but when you've convinced yourself that the future will be better, it justifies the present, and being a pro athlete was a privilege. Besides, if I was struggling those years, I had too much fun to notice. During a long race, for example, there's a lot of downtime. So once the early break is established, you can talk with your friends and screw around. If you have to pee, usually you go to the edge of the road on a downhill and get a teammate to push you while you relieve yourself at 30 miles an hour. I'd have someone push me so it looked like I was peeing, but I'd hold my water bottle waist high and squirt half the pack, who'd scream in horror until they saw where it came from. A quick water fight would ensue, the breakaway would get caught, and then we'd pay attention again. At the end, if my team won, we'd drink champagne, and if we lost, we'd drink beer. But either way, it was a party. Every year, one or two of my teammates would become lifelong friends. I've had a running joke with Brad Huff and Jeremy Powers since 2009, where we send each other photos with captions like, "Hey guys, did these shorts fit?" and "My testicles are hanging out of one side," for example. Once, at a bar, with people I'd just met, a girl laughed at a video her boyfriend sent of a penis flopping around, and then showed it to the table. "How the hell do you know Jeremy Powers?" I asked. She was confused, because the picture was just from the upper thigh to the belly button, but I'd recognize that dick anywhere. Turns out her boyfriend was on Power's team. My phone still has a mile of my friend's genitals on it, and I never stopped laughing those years, piling up great relationships and once-in-a-lifetime experiences. By 25, counting a family trip to Hawaii when I was a kid, I'd been to 49 states. Alaska, get your shit together and put on a bike race. And competed on 3 continents, just not the one that mattered. Sometimes I'd even win, and no matter how bleak my prospects looked, for that moment when those victory chemicals rushed through me, I was living the dream. We finally caught on that cheating was rampant in the World Tour. Lots of sports had drug problems, but doping was particularly effective for time trials in Alps. So in cycling, the most corrupt rose to the top. Even at the continental level, I had to report my whereabouts to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, USADA. Roommates would get home to find me with a USADA representative and a chaperone, signing forms and sealing up bottles of urine at the kitchen table, the last place you want to see bodily fluids. The biggest drug scandal so far was called Operation Puerto, in which authorities found 211 bags of blood and plasma in possession of a shady doctor. The bags were labeled with code names corresponding to the rider who gave them, so while a legal battle made it impossible to confirm, you could figure out who was who. For example, he denied it, but 20 bags were attributed to a Spaniard named Francisco Mancebo. Mancebo couldn't find a job in the shrinking European peloton, so he made a living on an American continental team instead. I doubt if he was doping anymore, but Mancebo's engine was bored out from years of dirty grand tours, so in low-level races, he was unstoppable. Like a boss in a video game, I finally got past everyone else, and then I had to find a way to beat him. As more scandals broke, sponsors saw cycling as a risk and big teams folded. I was young and still improving, but with fewer jobs available, every year was a bad year. Talented up-and-comers went back to school at 25 or retired at 30, and a teammate named Pat Lemieux was living with me when he started dating a pro triathlete named Gwen Jorgensen. When she won a few races and decided to quit her day job as an accountant to chase her Olympic dreams, we all agreed that it made more sense for Pat to follow her around, fix her bike, and cook her meals than it did to cram into my Toyota for another criterium. I thought that every season might be my last, but I'd always get a contract that was sort of enough to get by on if I hustled on the side, and there was always one win, one moment of hope I could cling to. That was all it took to sign on the dotted line, and with every rider who gave up or moved on, I got a little closer to the top. Bitter at 25, I got a tattoo that says clean on my right biceps, where you couldn't miss it when I raised my arm on a podium. People thought it was because I hated dopers, and I admit I ran my mouth at those guys every chance I got. But here's the real reason. I understood why someone might cheat. I wanted it so bad that it scared me, and the tattoo was meant to give me resolve in case I was tempted. Pros Nick Waite, Adam Meyerson, Isaac Howe, and Brad Huff got similar designs, and we made a pact. If you dope, the rest of us will come find you, and we'll scrape it off with a cheese grater. It finally came out that Armstrong, the face of our sport, wasn't just cheating like everyone else. He was a mastermind, hiring top doctors and innovating new methods to win at all costs. While his rivals got caught, Lance used his power and money to go after anyone who got in his way, suing a former soigneur who spoke out, and leaving threatening voicemails that made his enemies fear for their families. Frankie Andreu was one of the first to confess, and he was blacklisted in the industry for years, finally returning as director of my Kenda team. I try to empathize and understand the gray areas, but my former hero seemed to be a sociopath, comic book evil. I feared that Dad was right and I was wasting my time, but things seemed to be changing in the World Tour. Jonathan Vauters, who'd also been teammates with Lance, built a new team that focused on anti-doping and hired a bunch of Americans to race clean in Europe, like David taking on Goliath. With his huge sideburns, tiny budget, and riders wearing Argyle, it was hard to tell if JV was serious. But when he picked up Garmin as a title sponsor, other teams pushed away their needles, and the era of widespread doping began to fizzle out. I was just a dumb kid living out of his car and spending prize money on a tattoo, but watching Team Garmin race the Tour de France, I didn't feel so lost. I flew to China to finalize patterns for my clothing business and took on a partner to handle the day-to-day jobs, so I could train more and work part-time for a small monthly check. Then I spent my savings on an $80,000 foreclosed house in Athens, Georgia, tore out the dogfighting room the previous owner had built behind the garage, you heard that right, and converted it to a 1-1 apartment with a small kitchen. The new bedroom had a solid core door and no window to the outside, perfect for sleep and recovery. I filled the garage with bikes, and upstairs were 3 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms I could rent out for income. Athens is a great town for a pro cyclist on a budget. A parking ticket was $4, and one of my training routes included 2 covered bridges and a gas station where a generous square of cornbread was 25 cents. Between the business and the house, I had a pirate ship. Bills were paid, and bike racing went from a hobby to a job. I bought a juicer, got a weekly massage, and hired a coach to oversee my training. My parents still paid for my health insurance. Thanks to my pirate ship, I won the opening stage at the Redlands Classic, a legendary 5-day stage race near Los Angeles, considered a stepping stone to the world tour. I nearly fell apart on the final day when Mancebo attacked, but I ripped through corners in the pouring rain, dug so deep that I couldn't walk the next day, and caught him to take my first overall win, also known as the General Classification, or GC. The margin of victory? 2 seconds. That's what put me on the map. But it's also how close I was to failure, to having nothing to show for those years. I remembered watching Redlands as an amateur, and then being pack fodder my first time racing it, dreaming that I could win someday. Swinging from despair to hope, I cried on that podium, feeling for the first time that it was all going to be okay as I lifted my clean tattoo over Mancebo. I cried again when I was typing this, just thinking about that moment. I'm pathetic. The 6-figure salaries that went to previous Redlands winners were out of the question after all the scandal, so I was ecstatic to sign a $45,000 contract for 2013 with a well-funded Continental team called Bissell. It was still the minor leagues, but Bissell was always invited to the big American races, so I'd have a chance to compete against the World Tour teams. And I'd be flying there and staying at a hotel instead of driving and sleeping on an air mattress. And yes, the sponsorship included free vacuums. My floors in Athens were immaculate. Excuse me, I mean my deck. Things were looking up, but there was one problem. I was 25 years old, and only one guy had ever made it to the World Tour after a late start in a college degree. His name was Ted King. Ted realized that contracts don't always come with results, so he had to sell himself to teams and be marketable to sponsors. Pros made fun of Ted for writing a blog and using social media, but his relationship with Speedplay Pedals got his foot in the door with the World Tour, and he eventually became the token American on an Italian squad sponsored by Cannondale. Following his example, I made an effort to be worth more to teams than just race results, and I began promoting sponsors on social media and writing reviews in magazines. Folks would tweet me what kind of floors and pets they had, and I'd recommend an appropriate Bissell. I still get free vacuums. Mark Bissell is a nice guy. With all the pieces in place, starting in January 2013, I'd finally have a living wage and a shot at the big leagues. But when Kenda Pro Cycling ran out of money and folded in the middle of the season, I needed prize money and racing to stay in shape, so I accepted an invitation to be a guest rider, basically a hired gun, for an amateur team at the Tour of Trinidad, a 10-day stage race in the Caribbean in August, where the winner would take home a car. I was so desperate, I didn't even ask what kind. 100 riders piled into school buses at 5 a.m. in Port of Spain, Trinidad, for a 2-hour drive to the opening time trial, and the second stage was that evening in the same town. So instead of driving us back and forth to the hotel, they dropped us off at someone's house. After a meager lunch of white bread and baked beans, I rode into town in search of roti, a specialty in Trinidad, curried potatoes, chicken, and hot sauce wrapped in dough. When my stomach was satisfied, exhaustion set in, but the closest I found to a bed was an old roll of carpet, so I tore off a strip and fell asleep on the sidewalk, wrapped up like a roti. My teammate had the overall lead, so I was on the front when a police car that was assigned to stop traffic pulled into a gas station, leaving me to lead the pack through traffic with trucks zooming by at 60 miles an hour on both sides. The race offered a King of the Mountain prize for the first rider to the top of its biggest climbs, but summits were unmarked, so I laughed when they presented me with the traditional polka-dot jersey worn by the KOM leader. Someone said that I also won a bull as a prize, but I never saw it, so that might have been a joke. After the stage, I bought a six-pack of Coronas for my teammates and took the next flight home. They were angry to lose their ringer, but when two stages were canceled due to heavy rain and flooding, I tried to avoid Schadenfreude, a German word for taking pleasure in someone else's misfortune. By the end of the race, some of the riders suffered from a virus, with fever and stomach problems, and I tried to avoid Scheißenfreude, a word I just made up, for taking pleasure in someone else's diarrhea. I never found out what kind of car went to the winner. I bet it was used, or Hot Wheels. And someone there owes me a bull. Back in Georgia, I took a few weeks off to rest after a long season, using the time to work on a book about my journey through cycling. Comfortable in my house in Georgia, with my first real paycheck as a pro athlete on the way, I thought that my story was over, that it was happily ever after. But when I showed my draft to a publisher, they said I didn't have enough of an ending, which was true, but sort of sad and insulting. By then, I'd found riding was like scratching an itch, so that fall and winter, every minute I wasn't on the bike, I was staring at my laptop. When I finally re-emerged, friends said I'd disappeared for months, but trying to explain things to imaginary readers had helped me understand them myself, forcing me to process emotions I'd been too busy to feel. I made apologetic phone calls to friends whose weddings I'd missed, and I contacted former teammates to thank them for something encouraging they'd said, which they usually didn't remember. I resolved to find balance and be a better person, and then I went to wine night at a bar with my buddies, where a glass of Cabernet and a slice of pizza was $4.50, and I went home with the bartender. She had blue hair. I didn't think it would ever leave my laptop, but it still felt good to finish my book. The theme of pro cycling on $10 a day, follow your dreams, but play it safe, stay in school, don't make too many sacrifices. You get the idea, but I don't know how I feel about that anymore. Part 1. Life in the Post-Dopocalypse. Chapter 1. Pro cycling had tickled the mainstream for a year or two, but 2013 was an era that I like to call the post-dopocalypse. When mainstream sponsors threw in the towel, managers had to make do with whatever money they could squeeze out of the bike industry. More teams folded, and the sport was a barren wasteland of the one I'd watched as a teenager. In most sports, when someone gets caught doping, they're outcasts and often don't come back. But in cycling, drugs were too widespread and too entrenched. Guys like Lance's former coach Chris Carmichael had probably made his name on the wrong side of the rules, for example. But he rode the wave into a successful coaching business, which remains to this day. Of the teams that managed to stay afloat, most of the directors and managers were former dopers, and races were won by guys who'd either served suspensions or gotten away with it. The pact was filled with prominent jaws and foreheads, side effects from human growth hormone, and nearly a third of the World Tour racers had prescriptions for asthma inhalers, a semi-legal performance enhancer. I loved Alberto Contador's toughness and racing style, but then I'd see old footage of him attacking Lance on climbs. He must have been cheating back then, so is he still doing it? Is he only winning because of the drugs he did before? Then Contador tested positive for clenbuterol and blamed it on a contaminated steak. His team manager was Bjarne Riis, known as Mr. 58, for his off-the-charts hematocrit from EPO abuse back when he was a racer. One World Tour team was sponsored by Katusha, a Soviet artillery manufacturer. The marketing was so effective, when my old rocket launcher broke, I went right out and bought a Katusha. Another big team was owned by Alexander Vinokourov. It sure looked like he'd bribed a Colombian rider to let him win the 2012 Olympic road race. They both deny it, but the Olympics are supposed to be sacred, and it didn't feel right when Vino became the boss of Team Astana, funded by the Kazakhstani government. In the dopocalypse, every time I thought the sport was cleaned up, someone I'd race against or looked up to would test positive. Young pros would never see drugs, but it was hard to know who to cheer for, and spectators were skeptical of every performance. Talking about EPO like basketball fans might debate whether Jordan in his prime would beat LeBron. endless hypotheticals of who's doing it, who's not, and who stopped but definitely used to. They trusted guys with clean tattoos, but we didn't win very often.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?